At last, Bernie's eyes open. His gnarled hands, which have spilled so much blood, now reach down to feel the dampness of his own blood seeping through his shirt. He looks, sees what has bloomed there, and lets out a scream of horror and cowardice. It does not strike him as just that after murdering so many children, he should have been mortally wounded by a blind man. It strikes him as hideous, unfair. For the first time, he is visited by an extremely unpleasant idea. What if there's more to pay for the things he has done over the course of his long career? He has seen Endworld. He has seen Conger Road, which winds through it to Din Ta. The blasted, burning landscape surrounding Conger Road is like hell, and surely Antak, the big combination, is hell itself. What if such a place waits for him? What if... There's a horrible, paralyzing pain in his guts. Mr. Munshun, now almost fully materialized, has reached out and twisted one smoky, not quite transparent hand in the wound Henry inflicted with his switchblade knife. Bernie squeals. Tears run down the old child murderer's cheeks.
Don't hurt me! Then do as I say. I can't, Bernie snivels. I'm dying. Look at all the blood. Do you think I can get past something like this? I'm 85 fucking years old. Duff break, Burn Burn. But there are those on the other side who could heal you of your wounds.
Mr. Munshun, like Black House itself, is hard to look at. He shivers in and out of focus. Sometimes that hideously long face, it obscures most of his body, like the bloated head of a caricature on some newspaper's op-ed page, has two eyes, sometimes just one. Sometimes there seem to be tufted snarls of orange hair leaping up from his distended skull, and sometimes Mr. Munshun appears to be as bald as Yul Brynner. Only the red lips and the fangy, pointed teeth that lurk inside them remain fairly constant. Bernie eyes his accomplice with a degree of hope. His hands, meanwhile, continue to explore his stomach, which is now hard and bloated with lumps. He suspects the lumps are clots. Oh, that someone should have hurt him so badly. That wasn't supposed to happen. That was never supposed to happen. He was supposed to be protected. He was supposed to...
It is not even beyond the realm of possibility, Mr. Munshun says, that the years could be rolled away from you, just as the sun was rolled away from the mouth of Jesus Christ's doom. To be young again, Bernie says, and exhales a low, harsh sigh. His breath stinks of blood and spoilage. Yes, I'd like that. Of course. And such things are possible, Mr. Munshun says, nodding his grotesquely unstable face. Such gifts are the abalas to give. But they are not promised, Charles, my little munching munchkin. But I can make you one promise.
The creature in the black evening suit and red ascot leaps forward with dreadful agility. His long-fingered hand darts again into Chummy Burnside's shirt, this time clenches into a fist, and produces a pain beyond any the old monster has ever dreamed of in his own life, although he has inflicted this and more on the innocent. Mr. Munshun's reeking countenance pushes up to Bernie's. The single eye glares.
Do you feel that, Bernie? Do you, you miserable old bag of dirt and sorrow? Ho, ho, ha, ha, of course you do. It is your intestines I have in my hand. And if you do not move now, Schweinhund, I will rip them from your bleeding body, ho, ho, ha, ha, and wrap them around your neck. You will die knowing you are choking on your own guts. A trick I learned from Fritz himself, Fritz Harmon, who was so young and lovely. Now, what do you say? Will you bring him, or will you choke?
I'll bring him, Bernie screams. I'll bring him, only stop! Stop, you're tearing me apart!
Bring him to the station. The station, Burn Burn. This one is not for the rat's holes, the fox holes, not for the combination. No bleeding footsies for Dialer. He works for his abala with this.
A long finger tipped with a brutal black nail goes to the huge forehead and taps it above the eyes. For the moment, Bernie sees two of them, and then the second is once more gone.
Understand?
Yes! Yes!
His guts are on fire, and still the hand in his shirt twists and twists. The terrible highway of Mr. Munshun's face hangs before him.
The station where you brought the other special ones.
Yes!
Mr. Munshun lets go. He steps back. Mercifully for Bernie, he is beginning to grow insubstantial again, to discorporate. Yellowed clippings swim into view not behind him but through him. Yet the single eye hangs in the air above the paling blotch of the ascot.
Make sure he wears the cab. This one especially must wear the cab.
Burnside nods eagerly. He still smells faintly of mycin perfume.
The cap! Yes, I have the cap.
Be careful, Bernie. You are old and hurt. The boy is young and desperate. Flit of foot if you let him get away.
In spite of the pain, Bernie smiles. One of the children getting away from him, even one of the special ones, what an idea.
Don't worry, he says. Just if you speak to him, to Abaladun, tell him I'm not past it yet. If he makes me better, he won't regret it. And if he makes me young again, I'll bring him 1,000 young, 1,000 breakers.
Fading and fading. Now Mr. Munshun is again just a glow, a milky disturbance on the air of Bernie's sitting room deep in the house he once abandoned for Maxton's. When he realized he really did need someone to take care of him in his sunset years.
Bring him just this one, Burn. Bring him just this one, and you will be rewarded.
Mr. Munshun is gone. Bernie stands and bends over the horsehair sofa. Doing it squeezes his belly, and the resulting pain makes him scream, but he doesn't stop. He reaches into the darkness and pulls out a battered black leather sack. He grasps its top and leaves the room, limping and clutching at his bleeding, distended belly. And what of Tyler Marshall, who has existed through most of this story as little more than a rumor? How badly has he been hurt? How frightened is he? Has he managed to retain his sanity? As to his physical condition, he's got a concussion, but that's already healing. The fisherman has otherwise done no more than stroke his arm and his buttocks, a creepy touch that made Tyler think of the witch in Hansel and Gretel. Mentally, would you be shocked to hear that while Mr. Munshun is goading Bernie onward, Fred and Judy's boy is happy? He is. He is happy. And why not? He's at Miller Park. The Milwaukee Brewers have confounded all the pundits this year, all the doomsayers who proclaimed they'd be in the cellar by July 4th. While it's still relatively early, but the 4th has come and gone, and the brew crew has returned to Miller tied for first place with Cincinnati. They are in the hunt, in large part due to the bat of Richie Sexson, who came over to Milwaukee from the Cleveland Indians, and who has been really picking taters in the pungent terminology of George Rathbun. They are in the hunt, and Ty is at the game. Excellent. Not only is he there, he's got a front row seat. Next to him, big, sweating, red-faced, a Kingsland beer in one hand and another tucked away beneath his seat for emergencies, is the gorgeous George himself, bellowing at the top of his leather lungs. Jeremy Burnitz of the crew has just been called out at first on a bang-bang play, and while there can be no doubt that the Cincinnati shortstop handled the ball well and got rid of it fast, there can also be no doubt, at least not in George Rathbun's mind, that Burnitz was safe. He rises in the twilight, his sweaty, bald pate glowing beneath a sweetly lavender sky, a foamy rill of beer rolling up one cocked forearm, his blue eyes twinkling. You can tell he sees a lot with those eyes, just about everything. And Ty waits for it. They all wait for it. And here it is, that avatar of summer in the coolie country. That wonderful bray that means everything is okay. Terror has been denied and slippage has been canceled.
Come on, Ump! Give us a break! Give us a freaking break! Even a blind man could see he was safe!
The crowd on the first base side goes wild at the sound of that cry, none wilder than the 14 or so people sitting behind the banner reading Miller Park welcomes George Rathbun and the winners of this year's KDCU Brewer Bash. Ty is jumping up and down, laughing, waving his brew crew hat. What makes this doubly boss is that he thought he forgot to enter the contest this year. He guesses his father, or perhaps his mother, entered it for him, and he won. Not the grand prize, which was getting to be the Brew Crew's bat boy for the entire Cincinnati series, but what he got, besides this excellent seat with the other winners, that is, in his opinion, even better. Of course, Richie Sexson isn't Mark McGwire. Nobody can hit the tar out of the ball like Big Mac. But Sexson has been awesome for the Brewers this year. Just awesome. And Tyler Marshall is one. Someone is shaking his foot. Ty attempts to pull away, not wanting to lose this dream, this most excellent refuge from the horror that has befallen him. But the hand is relentless. It shakes and shakes. Wake up! A voice snarls. And the dream begins to darken. George Rathbun turns to Ty, and the boy sees an amazing thing. The eyes that were such a shrewd, sharp blue only a few seconds ago have gone dull and milky. Cripe, he's blind, Ty thinks. George Rathbun really is a wake up, the growling voice says. It's closer now. In a moment the dream will wink out entirely. Before it does, George speaks to him. The voice is quiet, totally unlike the sportscaster's usual brash bellow. Help's on the way, he says. So be cool, you little cat. Be wake up, you shit! The grip on his ankle is crushing, paralyzing. With a cry of protest, Ty opens his eyes. This is how he rejoins the world and our tale. He remembers where he is immediately. It's a cell, with reddish-gray iron bars halfway along a stone corridor lit with cobwebby electric bulbs. There's a dish of some sort of stew in one corner. In the other is a bucket in which he's supposed to pee or take a dump if he has to. So far he hasn't, thank goodness. The only other thing in the room is a raggedy old futon from which Bernie has just dragged him. All right, Bernie says. Awake at last, that's good. Now get up, on your feet, asswipe. I don't have time to fuck with you. Tyler gets up. A wave of dizziness rolls through him, and he puts his hand to the top of his head. There is a spongy, crusted place there. Touching it sends a bolt of pain all the way down to his jaws, which clench. But it also drives the dizziness away. He looks at his hand. There are flakes of scab and dried blood on his palm. That's where he hit me with his damned rock. Any harder and I would have been playing a harp. But the old man has been hurt somehow, too. His shirt is covered with blood. His wrinkled ogre's face is waxy and pallid. Behind him, the cell door is open. Ty measures the distance to the hallway, hoping he's not being too obvious about it. But Bernie has been in this game a long time. He has had more than one little one try to escape on his bleeding footsies. Oh, ho. He reaches into his bag and brings out a black gadget with a pistol grip and a stainless steel nozzle at the tip. Know what this is, Tyler? Bernie asks. Taser, Ty says, isn't it? Bernie grins, revealing the stumps of his teeth. Smart boy. A TV-watching boy, I'll be bound. It's a taser, yes. But a special type. It'll drop a cow at 30 yards. Understand? You try to run, boy, I'll bring you down like a ton of bricks. Come out here. Ty steps out of the cell. He has no idea where this horrible old man means to take him, but there's a certain relief just in being free of the cell. The futon was the worst. He knows somehow that he hasn't been the only kid to cry himself to sleep on it with an aching heart and an aching lumpy head. Nor the 10th, nor probably the 50th. Turn to your left. Ty does. Now the old man is behind him. A moment later, he feels the bony fingers grip the right cheek of his bottom. It's not the first time the old man has done this. Each time it happens, he's reminded again of the witch and Hansel and Gretel asking the lost children to stick their arms out of their cage. But this time his touch is different. Weaker. Die soon, Ty thinks. And the thought, its cold collectedness, is very, very Judy. Die soon, old man, so I don't have to. This one is mine, the old man says, but he sounds out of breath, no longer quite sure of himself. I'll bake half, fry to rest, with bacon. I don't think you'll be able to eat much, Ty says, surprised at the calmness of his own voice. Looks like somebody ventilated your stomach pretty. There's a crackling, accompanied by a hideous, jittery, burning sensation in his left shoulder. Ty screams and staggers against the wall across the corridor from his cell, trying to clutch the wounded place, trying not to cry, trying to hold on to just a little of his beautiful dream about being at the game with George Rathbun and the other KDCU Brewer Bash winners. He knows he actually did forget to enter this year, but in dreams such things don't matter. That's what's so beautiful about them. Oh, but it hurts so bad. And despite all his efforts, all the Judy Marshall in him, the tears begin to flow. "You want another one?" the old man gasps. He sounds both sick and hysterical, and even a kid Ty's age knows that's a dangerous combination. "You want another one? Just for good luck?"
"No," Ty gasps. "Don't zap me again, please don't."
"Then start walking, and no more smart goddamn remarks."
Ty starts to walk. Somewhere he can hear water dripping. Somewhere very faint, he can hear the laughing caw of a crow. Probably the same one that tricked him, and how he'd like to have Ebby's 22 and blow its evil shiny black feathers off. The outside world seems light years away. But George Rathbun told him help was on the way. And sometimes the things you heard in dreams came true. His very own mother told him that once, and long before she started to go all wonky in the head, too. They come to a stairway that seems to circle down forever. Up from the depths comes a smell of sulfur and a roast of heat. Faintly he can hear what might be screams and moans. The clank of machinery is louder. There are ominous creaking sounds that might be belts and chains. Ty pauses, thinking the old guy won't zap him again unless he absolutely has to. Because Ty might fall down this long circular staircase, might hit the place on his head the old guy already clipped with the rock, or break his neck, or tumble right off the side. And the old guy wants him alive, at least for now. Ty doesn't know why, but he knows this intuition is true.
"Where are we going, mister?"
"You'll find out," Bernie says, in his tight, out-of-breath voice. "And if you think I don't dare zap you while we're on the stairs, my little friend, you're very mistaken. Now get walking."
Tyler Marshall starts down the stairs, descending past vast galleries and balconies, around and down, around and down. Sometimes the air smells of putrid cabbage. Sometimes it smells of burned candles. Sometimes of wet rot. He counts 150 steps, then stops counting. His thighs are burning. Behind him, the old man is gasping, and twice he stumbles, cursing and holding the ancient banister. "Fall, old man," Ty chants inside his head. "Fall and die, fall and die." But at last they are at the bottom. They arrive in a circular room with a dirty glass ceiling. Above them, gray sky hangs down like a filthy bag. There are plants oozing out of broken pots, sending greedy feelers across a floor of broken orange bricks. Ahead of them, two doors, French doors, Ty thinks they're called, stand open. Beyond them is a crumbling patio surrounded by ancient trees. Some are palms. Some, the ones with the hanging ropey vines, might be banyans. Others he doesn't know. One thing he's sure of, they are no longer in Wisconsin. Standing on the patio is an object he knows very well, something from his own world. Tyler Marshall's eyes well up again at the sight of it, which is almost like the sight of a face from home in a hopelessly foreign place.
"Stop, monkey boy!" The old man sounds out of breath. "Turn around!"
When Tyler does, he's pleased to see that the blotch on the old man's shirt has spread even farther. Fingers of blood now stretch all the way to his shoulders, and the waistband of his baggy old blue jeans has gone a muddy black. But the hand holding the taser is rock steady.
"God damn you," Tyler thinks. "God damn you to hell."
The old man has put his bag on a little table. He simply stands where he is for a moment, getting his breath. Then he rummages in the bag, something in there utters a faint metallic clink, and brings out a soft brown cap. It's the kind guys like Sean Connery sometimes wear in the movies. The old man holds it out.
"Put it on. And if you try to grab my hand, I'll zap you."
Tyler takes the cap, His fingers, expecting the texture of suede, are surprised by something metallic, almost like tinfoil. He feels an unpleasant buzzing in his hand, like a mild version of the taser's jolt. He looks at the old man pleadingly. "Do I have to?" Bernie raises the taser and bares his teeth in a silent grin. Reluctantly, Ty puts the cap on. This time the buzzing fills his head. For a moment he can't think, and then the feeling passes, leaving him with an odd sense of weakness in his muscles and a throbbing at his temples.
"Special boys need special toys," Bernie says, and it comes out "special boys, special toys."
As always, Mr. Munshun's ridiculous accent has rubbed off a little, thickening that touch of South Chicago Henry detected on the 911 tape.
"Now we can go out."
"Because with the cap on, I'm safe," Ty thinks. But the idea breaks up and drifts away almost as soon as it comes. He tries to think of his middle name and realizes he can't. He tries to think of the Bad Crow's name and can't get that either. Was it something like Corgi? No, that's a kind of dog. The cap is messing him up, he realizes. And that's what it's supposed to do. Now they pass through the open doors and onto the patio. The air is redolent with the smell of the trees and bushes that surround the backside of Black House, a smell that is heavy and cloying, fleshy somehow. The gray sky seems almost low enough to touch. Ty can smell sulfur and something bitter and electric and juicy. The sound of machinery is much louder out here. The thing Ty recognized sitting on the broken bricks is an easy-go golf cart, the Tiger Woods model.
"My dad sells these," Ty says, "at Goltz's, where he works."
"Where do you think it came from, asswipe? Get in, behind the wheel."
Ty looks at him, amazed. His blue eyes, perhaps thanks to the effects of the cap, have grown bloodshot and rather confused.
"I'm not old enough to drive."
"Oh, you'll be fine. A baby could drive this baby, behind the wheel."
Ty does as he is told. In truth, he has driven one of these in the lot at Goltz's, with his father sitting watchfully beside him in the passenger seat. Now the hideous old man is easing himself into that same place, groaning and holding his perforated midsection. The taser is in the other hand, however, and the steel tip remains pointed at Ty. The key is in the ignition. Ty turns it. There's a click from the battery beneath them. The dashboard light reading charge glows bright green. Now all he has to do is push the accelerator pedal, and steer, of course.
"Good so far,"
the old man says. He takes his right hand off his middle and points with a blood-stained finger. Ty sees a path of discolored gravel. Once, before the trees and underbrush encroached, it was probably a driveway leading away from the house.
"Now go, and go slow. Speed and I'll zap you. Try to crash us and I'll break your wrist for you. Then you can drive one-handed."
Ty pushes down on the accelerator. The golf cart jerks forward. The old man lurches, curses, and waves the taser threateningly.
"It would be easier if I could take off the cap," Ty says. "Please, I'm pretty sure that if you just let me
know..." "Cap stays. Drive!"
Ty pushes down gently on the accelerator. The easy-go rolls across the patio, its brand-new rubber tires crunching on broken shards of brick. There's a bump as they leave the pavement and go rolling up the driveway. Heavy fronds, they feel damp, sweaty, brush Tyler's arms. He cringes. The golf cart swerves. Bernie jabs the taser at the boy, snarling.
"Next time you get the juice, it's a promise."
A snake goes writhing across the overgrown gravel up ahead, and Ty utters a little scream through his clenched teeth. He doesn't like snakes, didn't even want to touch the harmless little corn snake Mrs. Loker brought to school, and this thing is the size of a python, with ruby eyes and fangs that prop its mouth open in a perpetual snarl.
"Go! Drive!"
The taser waving in his face, the cap buzzing faintly in his ears, behind his ears. The drive curves to the left. Some sort of tree, burdened with what look like tentacles, leans over them. The tips of the tentacles tickle across Ty's shoulders and the goose-prickled hair on end nape of his neck.
Our boy.
He hears this in his head in spite of the cap. It's faint, it's distant, but it's there.
Our boy, yes. Ours.
Bernie is grinning.
Hear 'em, don't you? They like you. So do I. We're all friends here, don't you see?
The grin becomes a grimace. He clutches his bloody middle again.
Goddamned blind old fool, he gasps.
Then suddenly the trees are gone. The golf cart rolls out onto a sullen, crumbling plain. The bushes dwindle, and Ty sees that farther along they give way entirely to a crumbled, rocky scree. Hills rise and fall beneath that sullen gray sky. A few birds of enormous size wheel lazily. A shaggy, slump-shouldered creature staggers down a narrow defile and is gone from sight before Ty can see exactly what it is. Not that he wanted to. The thud and pound of machinery is stronger, shaking the earth. The crump of pile drivers, the clash of ancient gears, the squall of cogs. Tyler can feel the golf cart's steering wheel thrumming in his hands. Ahead of them, the driveway ends in a wide road of beaten earth. Along the far side of it is a wall of round white stones.
That thing you hear, that's the Crimson King's power plant, Bernie says.
He speaks with pride, but there is more than a tinge of fear beneath it.
The big combination. 1,000,000 children have died on its belts, and 1,000,000,000 more to come for all I know. But that's not for you, Tyler. You might have a future after all. First, though, I'll have my piece of you. Yes, indeed.
His blood-streaked hand reaches out and caresses the top of Ty's buttock.
A good agent's entitled to 10%. Even an old buzzard like me knows that.
The hand draws back. Good thing. Ty has been on the verge of screaming, holding the sound back only by thinking of sitting at Miller Park with good old George Rathbun. If I'd really entered the Brewer Bash, he thinks none of this would have happened. But he thinks that may not actually be true. Some things are meant to be, that's all. Meant. He just hopes that what this horrible old creature wants is not one of them.
Turn left, Bernie grunts, settling back. 3 miles, give or take.
And as Tyler makes the turn, he realizes the ribbons of mist rising from the ground aren't mist at all. They're ribbons of smoke.
Sheol, Bernie says, as if reading his mind. And this is the only way through it, Conger Road. Get off it, and there are things out there that'd pull you to pieces just to hear you scream. My friend told me where to take you, but there might be just a little change of plan.
His pain-racked face takes on a sulky cast. Ty thinks it makes him look extraordinarily stupid.
He hurt me, pulled my guts. I don't trust him.
And, in a horrible child sing-song,
Carl Beerstone, don't trust Mr. Munchun. Not no more, not no more.
Ty says nothing. He concentrates on keeping the golf cart in the middle of Conger Road. He risks one look back, but the house in its ephemeral wallow of tropical greenery is gone, blocked from view by the first of the eroded hills.
He'll have what's his, but I'll have what's mine. Do you hear me, boy?
When Ty says nothing, Bernie brandishes the taser.
You hear me, you asswipe monkey?
Yeah, Ty says. Yeah, sure. Why don't you die? God, if you're there, why don't you just reach down and put your finger on his rotten heart and stop it from beating?
When Bernie speaks again, his voice is sly.
You looked at the wall on t'other side, but I don't think you looked close enough. Better take another gander.
Tyler looks past the slumped old man. For a moment he doesn't understand, and then he does. The big white stones stretching endlessly away along the far side of Conger Road aren't stones at all. They're skulls.
What is this place? Oh, God, how he wants his mother! How he wants to go home!
Beginning to cry again, his brain numbed and buzzing beneath the cap that looks like cloth but isn't, Ty pilots the golf cart deeper and deeper into the furnace lands, into Sheol. Rescue, help of any kind, has never seemed so far away. Chapter 27. When Jack and Dale step into the air-conditioned cool, the sandbar is empty except for three people. Beezer and Doc are at the bar with soft drinks in front of them, an end-time sign if there ever was one, Jack thinks. Far back in the shadows, any further, and he'd be in the dive's primitive kitchen, Stinky Cheese is lurking. There is a vibe coming off the two bikers, a bad one, and Stinky wants no part of it. For one thing, he's never seen Beezer and Doc without Mouse, Sonny, and Kaiser Bill. For another, oh God, it's the California detective and the freaking chief of police. The jukebox is dark and dead, but the TV is on, and Jack's not exactly surprised to see that today's matinee movie on AMC features his mother and Woody Strode. He fumbles for the name of the film, and after a moment it comes to him, Execution Express. "You don't want to be in on this, B," Woody says. In this film, Lily plays a Boston heiress named Beatrice Lodge, who comes west and turns outlaw, mostly to spite her straight-laced father. "This is looking like the gang's last ride." "Good," Lily says. Her voice is stony, her eyes stonier. The picture is crap, but as always, she is dead on character. Jack has to smile a little. "What?" Dale asks him. "The whole world's gone crazy, so what's to smile about?" On TV, Woody Strode says, "What do you mean, good? The whole damn world's gone crazy." Jack Sawyer says very softly, "We're going to gun down as many as we can. Let them know we were here." On the screen, Lily says the same thing to Woody. The two of them are about to step aboard the Execution Express, and heads will roll, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Dale looks at his friend, dazed. "I know most of her lines," Jack says, almost apologetically. "She was my mother, you see." Before Dale can answer, supposing any answer came to mind, Jack joins Beezer and Doc at the bar. He looks up at the Kingsland Ale clock next to the television. 11:40. It should be high noon. In situations like this, it's always supposed to be high noon, isn't it? "Jack," Beezer says and gives him a nod. "How you doing, buddy?" "Not too bad. You boys carrying?" Doc lifts his vest, disclosing the butt of a pistol. "It's a Colt 9. Beezer's got one of the same. Good iron, all registered and proper." He glances at Dale. "You along for the ride, are you?" "It's my town," Dale says, "and the fisherman just murdered my uncle. I don't understand very much of what Jack's been telling me, but I know that much. And if he says there's a chance we can get Judy Marshall's boy back, I think we'd better try it." He glances at Jack. "I brought you a service revolver, one of the Ruger automatics. It's out in the car." Jack nods absently. He doesn't care much about the guns, because once they're on the other side, they'll almost certainly change into something else. Spears, possibly, javelins, maybe even slingshots. It's going to be the Execution Express, all right. The Sawyer gang's last ride. But he doubts if it'll be much like the one in this old movie from the 60s. Although he'll take the Ruger. There might be work for it on this side. One never knows, does one? "Ready to saddle up?" Beezer asks Jack. His eyes are deep-socketed, haunted. Jack guesses the bees didn't get much sleep last night. He glances up at the clock again and decides, for no other reason than pure superstition, that he doesn't want to start for the Black House just yet after all. They'll leave the sandbar when the hands on the Kingsland clock stand at straight-up noon, no sooner. The Gary Cooper witching hour. "Almost," he says. "Have you got the map, bees?" "I got it. But I also got an idea. You don't really need it, do you?" "Maybe not," Jack allows. "But I'll take all the insurance I can get." Beezer nods. "I'm down with that. I sent my old lady back to her ma's in Idaho. After what happened with poor old Mousy, I didn't have to argue too hard. Never sent her back before, man. Not even the time we had our bad rumble with the pagans. But I got a terrible feeling about this." He hesitates, then comes right out with it. "Feel like none of us are coming back." Jack puts a hand on Beezer's meaty forearm. "Not too late to back out. I won't think any less of you." Beezer mulls it over, then shakes his head. "Amy comes to me in my dreams sometimes. We talk. How am I going to talk to her if I don't stand up for her? No, man, I'm in." Jack looks at Doc. I'm with Bees, Doc says. Sometimes you just gotta stand up. Besides, after what happened to Mouse... He shrugs. God knows what we might have caught from him, or fucking around out there at that house. Future might be short after that no matter what. How'd it turn out with Mouse? Jack inquires. Doc gives a short laugh. Just like he said. Around 3 o'clock this morning, we just washed old Mousy down the tub drain. Nothing left but foam and hair. He grimaces as if his stomach is trying to revolt, then quickly downs his glass of Coke. If we're going to do something, Dale blurts, let's just do it. Jack glances up at the clock. It's 11:50 now. Soon. I'm not afraid of dying, Beezer says abruptly. I'm not even afraid of that devil dog. It can be hurt if you pour enough bullets into it. We found that out. It's how that fucking place makes you feel. The air gets thick. Your head aches and your muscles get weak. And then, with a surprisingly good British accent, hangovers ain't in it, old boy. My gut was the worst, Doc says. That and... But he falls silent. He doesn't ever talk about Daisy Temperley, the girl he killed with an errant scratch of ink on a prescription pad. But he can see her now as clearly as the make-believe cowboys on the Sandbar's TV. Blonde, she was, with brown eyes. Sometimes he'd made her smile, even in her pain, by singing that song to her, the Van Morrison song about the brown-eyed girl. I'm going for Mouse, Doc says. I have to. But that place, it's a sick place. You don't know, man. You may think you understand, but you don't. I understand more than you think, Jack says. Now it's his turn to stop, to consider. Do Beezer and Doc remember the word Mouse spoke before he died? Do they remember Dayamba? They should. They were right there. They saw the book slide off their shelf and hang in the air when Jack spoke that word. But Jack is almost sure that if he asked them right now, they'd give him looks that are puzzled, or maybe just blank. Partly because Dayamba is hard to remember, like the precise location of the lane that leads from sane anti-slippage Route 35 to Black House. Mostly, however, because the word was for him, for Jack Sawyer, the son of Phil and Lily. He is the leader of the Sawyer gang because he is different. He has traveled, and travel is broadening. How much of this should he tell them? None of it, probably. But they must believe, and for that to happen, he must use Mouse's word. He knows in his heart that he must be careful about using it. Dayamba is like a gun. You can only fire it so many times before it clicks empty. And he hates to use it here. So far from Black House. But he will, because they must believe. If they don't, their brave quest to rescue Ty is apt to end with them all kneeling in Black House's front yard, noses bleeding, eyes bleeding, vomiting and spitting teeth into the poison air. Jack can tell them that most of the poison comes from their own minds, but talk is cheap. They must believe. Besides, it's still only 11:53. Lester, he says. The bartender has been lurking, forgotten, by the swing door into the kitchen. Not eavesdropping, he's too far away for that, but not wanting to move and attract attention. Now it seems that he's attracted some anyway. Have you got honey? Jack asks. Honey? Bees make it, Lester. Mokes make money and bees make honey. Something like comprehension dawns in Lester's eyes. Yeah, sure. I keep it to make Kentucky getaways. Also send it on the bar, Jack tells him. Dale stirs restively. If time's as short as you think, Jack, this is important. He watches Lester Moon put a small plastic squeeze bottle of honey on the bar and finds himself thinking of Henry. How Henry would have enjoyed the pocket miracle Jack is about to perform. But of course he wouldn't have needed to perform such a trick for Henry, wouldn't have needed to waste part of the precious word's power. Because Henry would have believed at once, just as he had believed he could drive from Trempolo to French Landing, hell to the fucking moon, if someone just dared to give him the chance and the car keys. I'll bring it to you, Lester says bravely. I ain't afraid. Just set it down on the far end of the bar, Jack tells him. That'll be fine. He does as asked. The squeeze bottle is shaped like a bear. It sits there in a beam of 6 minutes to noon sun. On the television, the gunplay has started. Jack ignores it. He ignores everything, focusing his mind as brightly as a point of light through a magnifying glass. For a moment, he allows that tight focus to remain empty, and then he fills it with a single word, Diyamba. At once, he hears a low buzzing. It swells to a drone. Beezer, Doc, and Dale look around. For a moment, nothing happens, and then the sunshiny doorway darkens. It's almost as if a very small rain cloud has floated into the sandbar. Stinky Cheese lets out a strangled squawk and goes flailing backward. Wasps! He shouts. Them are wasps! Get clear! But they are not wasps. Doc and Lester Moon might not recognize that, but both Beezer and Dale Gilbertson are country boys. They know bees when they see one. Jack, meanwhile, only looks at the swarm. Sweat has popped out on his forehead. He's concentrating with all his might on what he wants the bees to do. They cloud around the squeeze bottle of honey so thickly it almost disappears. Then their humming deepens, and the bottle begins to rise, wobbling from side to side like a tiny missile with a really shitty guidance system. Then, slowly, it wavers its way toward the Sawyer gang. The squeeze bottle is riding a cushion of bees 6 inches above the bar. Jack holds his hand out and open. The squeeze bottle glides into it. Jack closes his fingers, docking complete. For a moment, the bees rise around his head, their drone competing with Lily, who is shouting, "Save the tall bastard for me! He's the one who raped Stella!" Then they stream out the door and are gone. The Kingsland Ale clock stands at 11:57. "Holy Mary, Mother of God," Beezer whispers. His eyes are huge, almost popping out of their sockets. "You've been hiding your light under a bushel, looks like to me," Dale says. His voice is unsteady. From the end of the bar there comes a soft thud. Lester Stinky Cheese Moon has, for the first time in his life, fainted. "We're going to go now," Jack says. "Bees, you and Doc lead. We'll be right behind you in Dale's car. When you get to the lane and the no trespassing sign, don't go in. Just park your scoots. We'll go the rest of the way in the car, but first we're going to put a little of this under our noses." Jack holds up the squeeze bottle. It's a plastic version of Winnie the Pooh, grimy around the middle where Lester seizes it and squeezes it. We might even dab some in our nostrils. A little sticky, but better than projectile vomiting. Confirmation and approval are dawning in Dale's eyes. "Like putting Vicks under your nose in a murder scene," he says. It's nothing like that at all, but Jack nods, because this is about believing. "Will it work?" Doc asks doubtfully. "Yes," Jack replies. "You'll still feel some discomfort, I don't doubt that a bit, but it'll be mild. Then we're going to cross over to, well, to someplace else. After that, all bets are off." "I thought the kid was in the house," Bees says. "I think he's probably been moved. And the house, it's a kind of wormhole. It opens on another world," is the first word to come into Jack's mind. But somehow he doesn't think it is a world, not in the territory sense. On another place. On the TV, Lily has just taken the first of about 6 bullets. She dies in this one, and as a kid, Jack always hated that. But at least she goes down shooting. She takes quite a few of the bastards with her, including the tall one who raped her friend, and that is good. Jack hopes he can do the same. More than anything, however, he hopes he can bring Tyler Marshall back to his mother and father. Beside the television, the clock flicks from 11:59 to 12. "Come on, boys," Jack Sawyer says. "Let's saddle up and ride." Beezer and Doc mount their iron horses. Jack and Dale stroll toward the chief of police's car, then stop as a Ford pickup bolts into the sandbar's lot, skidding on the gravel and hurrying toward them, pulling a rooster tail of dust into the summer air. "Oh, Christ," Dale murmurs. Jack can tell from the 2 small baseball caps sitting ludicrously on the driver's head that it's Fred Marshall. But if Ty's father thinks he's going to join the rescue mission, he'd better think again. "Thank God I caught you," Fred shouts as he all but tumbles from his truck. "Thank God!" "Who next?" Dale asks softly. "Wendell Green? Tom Cruise? George W. Bush arm-in-arm with Miss Fucking Universe?" Jack barely hears him. Fred is wrestling a long package from the bed of his truck, and all at once Jack is interested. The thing in that package could be a rifle, but somehow he doesn't think that's what it is. Jack suddenly feels like a squeeze bottle being levitated by bees, not so much acting as acted upon. He starts forward. "Hey, bro, let's roll," Beezer yells. Beneath him, his Harley explodes into life. "Let's..." Then Beezer cries out. So does Doc, who jerks so hard he almost dumps the bike idling between his thighs. Jack feels something like a bolt of lightning go through his head, and he reels forward into Fred, who is also shouting incoherently. For a moment, the two of them appear to be either dancing with the long, wrapped object Fred has brought them, or wrestling over it. Only Dale Gilbertson, who hasn't been to the territories, hasn't been close to Black House, and who is not Ty Marshall's father, is unaffected. Yet even he feels something rise in his head, something like an interior shout. The world trembles. All at once, there seems to be more color in it, more dimension.
"What was that?" he shouts. "Good or bad? Good or bad? What the hell is going on here?"
For a moment, none of them answer. They are too dazed to answer. While a swarm of bees is floating a squeeze bottle of honey along the top of a bar in another world, Bernie is telling Ty Marshall to face the wall, goddammit. Just face the wall. They are in a foul little shack. The sounds of clashing machinery are much closer. Ty can also hear screams and sobs and harsh yells and what can only be the whistling crack of whips. They are very near the big combination now. Ty has seen it, a great crisscrossing confusion of metal rising into the clouds from a smoking pit about half a mile east. It looks like a madman's conception of a skyscraper, a Rube Goldberg collection of chutes and cables and belts and platforms, everything run by the marching, staggering children who roll the belts and pull the great levers. Red-tinged smoke rises from it in stinking fumes. Twice, as the golf cart rolled slowly along, Ty at the wheel and Bernie leaning askew in the passenger seat with a taser pointed, squads of freakish green men passed them. Their features were scrambled, their skin plated and reptilian. They wore half-cured leather tunics from which tufts of fur still started in places. Most carried spears, several had whips.
"Overseers," Bernie said. "They keep the wheels of progress turning."
He began to laugh, but the laugh turned into a groan, and the groan into a harsh and breathless shriek of pain. "Good," Ty thought coldly. And then, for the first time, employing a favorite word of Ebby Wexler's, "Die soon, you motherfucker." About 2 miles from the back of Black House, they came to a huge wooden platform on their left. A gantry-like thing jutted up from it. A long post projected out from the top, almost to the road. A number of frayed rope ends dangled from it, twitching in the hot and sulphurous breeze. Under the platform, on dead ground that never felt the sun, were litters of bones and ancient piles of white dust. To one side was a great mound of shoes. Why they'd take the clothes and leave the shoes was a question Ty probably couldn't have answered, even had he not been wearing the cap, "Special Doys for Special Boys." But a disjointed phrase popped into his head, "Custom of the country." He had an idea that was something his father sometimes said, but he couldn't be sure. He couldn't even remember his father's face, not clearly. The gibbet was surrounded by crows. They jostled one another and turned to follow the humming progress of the easy-go. None was the special crow, the one with the name Ty could no longer remember, but he knew why they were here. They were waiting for fresh flesh to pluck. That's what they were doing. Waiting for newly dead eyes to gobble, not to mention the bare toesies of the shoe-deprived dead. Beyond the pile of discarded, rotting footwear, a broken track led off to the north, over a fuming hill.
"Station House Road," Bernie said.
He seemed to be talking more to himself than to Ty at that point, was perhaps edging into delirium. Yet still the taser pointed at Ty's neck, never wavering.
"That's where I'm supposed to be taking the special boy,"
taking the special boy. That's where the special ones go. Mr. Munchun's gone to get the Mono, the End World Mono. Once there were two others, Patricia and Blaine. They're gone, went crazy, committed suicide. Ty drove the cart and remained silent. But he had to believe old Burnburn was the one who had gone crazy. Crazier, he reminded himself. He knew about monorails, had even ridden one at Disney World in Orlando. But monorails named Blaine and Patricia? That was stupid. Station House Road fell behind them. Ahead, the rusty red and iron gray of the big combination drew closer. Ty could see moving ants on cruelly inclined belts. Children. Some from other worlds, perhaps, worlds adjacent to this one, but many from his own. Kids whose faces appeared for a while on milk cartons and then disappeared forever. Kept a little longer in the hearts of their parents, of course, but eventually growing dusty even there, turning from vivid memories into old photographs. Kids presumed dead, buried somewhere in shallow graves by perverts who would use them and then discarded them. Instead, they were here. Some of them, anyway. Many of them. Struggling to yank the levers and turn the wheels and move the belts, while the yellow-eyed, green-skinned overseers cracked their whips. As Ty watched, one of the ant specks fell down the side of the convoluted, steam-wreathed building. He thought he could hear a faint scream, or perhaps it was a cry of relief. "Beautiful day," Bernie said faintly. "I'll enjoy it more when I get something to eat. Having something to eat always, always perks me up." His ancient eyes studied Ty, tightening a little at the corners with sudden warmth. "Baby butt's the best eaten, but yours won't be bad. Nope, won't be bad at all. He said to take you to the station, but I ain't sure he'd give me my share, my commission. Maybe he's honest, maybe he's still my friend. But I think I'll just take my share first and make sure. Most agents take their 10% off the top." He reached out and poked Ty just below the belt line. Even through his jeans, the boy could feel the tough, blunt edge of the old man's nail. "I think I'll take mine off the bottom." A wheezy, painful laugh, and Ty was not exactly displeased to see a bright bubble of blood appear between the old man's cracked lips. "Off the bottom, get it?" The nail poked the side of Ty's buttock again. "I get it," Ty said. "You'll be able to break just as well," Bernie said. "It's just that when you fart, you'll have to do the old one-cheek sneak every time." More wheezing laughter. Yes, he sounded delirious, all right. Delirious or on the verge of it. Yet still the tip of the taser remained rock steady. "Keep on going, boy. Another half a mile up to Conger Road. You see a little shack with a tin roof down in a draw. It's on the right. It's a special place. Special to me. Turn in there." Ty, with no other choice, obeyed. And now, "Do what I tell you. Face the fucking wall. Put your hands up and through those loops." Ty couldn't define the word euphemism on a bet, but he knows calling those metal circlets loops is bullshit. What's hanging from the rear wall are shackles.